It's time again for the Scotty Johnny Podcast with your host, Scotty Johnny himself, John Barnett, and the ego himself, Cheddar Talk, Aaron Flottam. Talking Wisconsin sports, two mics, two crusty vets, two opinions, one based in reality and one based in what he read on Twitter. With music by Duluth Greats, Cars and Trucks, here's John and Aaron.
Welcome, welcome, one and all. Welcome into the Scotty Johnny Podcast. Thank you again to Holly Flottam for voicing our opener. I'm joined here today, as per usual, with Aaron Flottam.
John, speaking of voicing, have you been yelling at somebody? What's up with your voice, dude?
My three-year-old brought home something that he thought he'd share with all the rest of us, and so we're dealing with Fantastic. That. I'm a little out of voice, which is terrible for me going into the Easter services and feeling like my voice is just god-awful to listen to, but I still sing loudly because I don't know how to sing Hallelujah quietly.
No, it's 20% high, 80% how you sound, right?
Isn't yeah. Make up for quality with just volume. We are blessed as well this week. We have Andy Herman with us this week to help break down some draft stuff. So thank you, Andy, again for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's draft week. I'm excited. This is fantastic.
And he's still awake and kicking and everything, everybody.
For now. I haven't lost everything quite yet. I still got just enough energy to do a few podcasts and hopefully pass out on Sunday night.
That's good. We're glad that you made us one of them, Andy. So,
and the listeners are going to be happy too, because then it's going to be less of me during this podcast. Thank you, Andy.
Yeah, less of my
Anything
voice.
I can do to help.
Save us from Aaron. Of course, you can find Andy at Scotty Sports on Twitter. You also please listen to his Pack a Day podcast. Not just him, but he's on Pack a Day podcast, and it's a wonderful tool to listen to. It's a wonderful thing to get Packers news daily. I mean, we're a weekly show. We go a little long. He's got a great podcast. And again, we appreciate having him on here. But make sure you go listen to his shows. Anything else you want to push right now, Andy? Anything else you're working on?
Yeah, we'll have a big draft show on Friday night on Cheesehead TV. It'll be on the Cheesehead TV YouTube channel. I'll post it on my Twitter. But it's going to be a live show during night two of the draft. I'll be hosting it. I've got about 12 other people from the Packers blogosphere that'll be joining me as well. So it's going to be a really cool show, and definitely check it out.
Yes. That is a wonderful cast you have, and I'm very, very jealous of the group you get to hang around with a lot of the time there. Of course, you can also follow our show here at Scotty Johnny One. You can check out our website at scottyjohnny.com. We put up the podcast and just a couple little other things every now and then just to put something that we want to write about up there. You can follow me at jbarn54 and Aaron at Cheddar Talk. I'm cutting him off because we want to get right into Packers Talk with our main event.
Starting things off with the main event.
Okay, so I gave Andy a couple of things that I wanted to talk about and get his feeling on, because you've watched a lot more tape than I have, and admittedly so. I think one of the first things I wanted to talk about is I've talked a lot about Montez Sweat in these couple of weeks, because Bosa and Allen are definitely going to be out of it for the Packers at this point. But I'm very interested in him, and I've seen several tweets today saying he's just off teams' boards. Now, this is, I'll tell you, I'm a lawyer, and the biggest thing about being a lawyer is getting used to the idea of every day somebody walks in and just lies right to my face. And that is what this week of drafting is for you, Andy, is just every day this week, some team is coming in and just lying right to your face. What do we make of everything with Montez Sweat and his heart condition now?
Yeah, so this is the toughest thing about this process, is figuring out what's real, what's a smoke screen. And it's even tougher, obviously, when somebody's medical well-being is at stake, and you don't certainly want to make light of it. And so a couple things. One, we saw what happened with Maurice Hurst last year. He had a heart condition. He was going to be a top 15, top 20 pick. He was ultra talented. The heart condition came out, and he dropped until the fifth round. And the Raiders pounced on him and got a steal, assuming that that his heart stays the way that it's supposed to, and he stays healthy. They got a great pick, and it's even more unfortunate in that case for Maurice Hurst, because he lost a ton of money on a medical diagnosis that seemingly up to this point isn't affecting his play in any capacity. So that's the tough part about this, is you want these players, these ultra talented players who this means so much to, and they've put so much of their life into, you want to see them get drafted where they should. And it's just, really would be a shame to have a player like that 2 years in a row based off of a similar condition have the same type of fall. So I'm hoping, most importantly for Montez Sweat's case, that that's just not the case. And this is a smokescreen and teams are trying to push him down draft boards so that they can take him. But, you know, for me personally, it's impossible to tell whether or not that's a real thing. I've heard whispers that it's not within the same realm of what, Hurst's was from a season ago. And hopefully that's the case. But even if it's not as concerning, could it potentially push him from a top 10 pick to a second round pick? Maybe it could. And again, that would be too bad. I'm hopeful that it's not. I've said from the beginning, I've had this gut feeling that Montez Sweat would be a Packer. I think he would be a prime candidate to be in play for pick 12. There have been a handful of players in the last 20 years that have been 270 pounds plus and 6'6 or higher and ran a 4.5 or better 40. And he was the fastest at a 4.4 40. The next close was a tenth of a second slower, which was actually Jimmy Graham. So he's just an absolute free show. I think he's going to be able to set the edge better than people think earlier in his career. I don't think he's going to be a one-trick pony just as a pass rusher, which is why I think Brian Burns is in the same conversation as a Josh Allen, just because he brings so much to the table. Healthy, he's very much in play at number 12. I think he'd be a really smart pick and somebody that they could really build this defense around. However, if this is going to be a decision that's more up to the medical staff than it is up to the scouts. Cause if he's there at 12 and he's healthy, he could be a pretty no brainer pick. If the medical staff just says, hey, you can't do it, then, it's out of the scouts' hands at that point. But I think that's where it is. And I hope for Montez Sweat's case that his diagnosis is better than what it's been played out today on social media.
Well, Andy, too, another player that was it just last year or 2 years ago that the Jaguars got, Miles Jack was another one. It's not the same thing at all. It's a different condition altogether. I think his was microfractures in his shin or whatever it was like that. But, the jury's still kind of out on Miles Jack, but I think the Jaguars got a heck of a steal with him. On with, so I was listening to Lewis Riddick on the Dan Patrick show today, and there's a million and one opinions out there right now. But one of the ones that he brought up about Montez Sweat was that a lot of the stuff that you saw with him at the combine doesn't really line up with stuff that you see on tape, and that was kind of disconcerting for him. Is there anything like that with Montez Sweat that makes you kind of worry about him? Like maybe he's more of a flashy player than he actually is, like if you actually were to sit and watch every single tape, because obviously you've watched more tape than us.
Yeah, there's definitely a piece of that, and I think you have to weigh the two things out, right? So take the ridiculous athleticism aside. You look at him as a player just based off of film. To me, he is a late first type talent. He's not a top 15, top 12 type of talent. It's more of a late first, pick 25, pick 30, somewhere around there. That's what I kind of see on his tape. He's still a very good pass rusher. But you're totally right, and Lewis Riddick's totally right. That elite athleticism does not consistently flash on tape, and he should have been able to win a little bit more consistently, even in the difficult SEC. You would have liked to see him flash just a little bit more and have a little bit more production. But even without that elite athleticism, I think he's still a first-round grade. Now, you put in a freak show athletic testing like that, and what that says to me is that he's already good. And with coaching and with some additional technique work and putting on additional muscle and learning how to play this position at a high level in the NFL, he has a ceiling that is immeasurably high. And I think what you're hoping for is that the floor is what you saw at Mississippi State this last year, where he's a good pass rusher. He's a good defensive end slash edge rusher. And even if that top end athleticism doesn't totally pan out, you still get a good football player. But if he hits those athleticism traits and he can translate that ridiculous athleticism out onto the football field and start flashing with more regularity, then you've got potentially a guy that probably should have been a top five, top three pick that you just picked up at number 12. So I think that's what the combine shows to me is what his ultimate potential is. What his tape showed to me was a good but not great player.
Well, that was a pretty thorough answer. Thank you, Andy.
Yeah,
you
bet. And I like hearing much of what I've been saying the last couple of weeks. I love the I like the fact that he can play the run a lot better. Like the Brian Burns thing always kind of confounds me, because the number of times I watch him going up against mid-tier kind of linemen and not being able to hold his own in the run, I mean, Clay Matthews' big problem this last year for me was he kept trying to undercut runs because he wasn't taking on blocks. And I like that Sweat can hold that edge in the way that a healthy Nick Perry one time did for like a season at least.
Yep. And they got paid.
Yeah, and then didn't do it again. Yes. Two of the other guys we talked about a little bit last week, but I really want to hear what your thoughts are on this. The Devons, I'm calling them, for anybody who's watched Big Mouth on Netflix. Devin Bush, Devin White, both kind of they're the upper tier inside linebackers, and there's some talk that maybe Bush or White, or I don't know that anyone's predicted both, but some of them have one of those two available at 12 at that point. What are your thoughts on these two? And I'm more interested in Bush than in White, because I think he's more likely available for the Packers than White is.
Yeah, certainly it seems at this point, and again, you never quite know. Somebody's always going to fall that you don't expect, and somebody's always going to go way ahead of what you expect. But it seems at this point like Devin White's probably going to be gone and that Devin Bush is probably going to be there. Again, you never know for sure, but it seems that's kind of the way things are leaning. I'll just kind of give a quick breakdown on both. Let me start by saying off-ball linebacker at pick 12 is probably not the ideal scenario for me. I just don't see that as having a ton of value. To me, this is a position that a little bit you can kind of use a little bit more of a platoon than other positions in the NFL. On early downs, you can use a guy like Blake Martinez, who's good enough against the run, good enough against the pass. He can kind of hold his own. And then you get into obvious passing downs, and that's when you can kind of bring some of those safeties down in the box, play them as inside linebackers, use a Josh Jones, maybe even use an Adrian Amos in that type of role, and you can get a little bit more creative. If I'm taking an inside linebacker at pick 12, it has to be not only somebody that's going to be a three down player and probably potentially a four down player. It also has to be somebody that I think can play the pass really, really well, has really great instincts, and can take on guards and centers that are getting to the second level at the point of attack. And let me start with Devin White. I think he can do a lot of what I just said, and I think that's why he's going to go before Devin Bush. He's got a little bit more size, a little bit more strength, but the one question I have is the instincts. He makes up for a lot of his instinctual mistakes based off of his athleticism. There are times where he kind of gets a little bit confused by the eye candy that kind of goes on in the backfield at times. You'll see him hit the wrong gap. You'll see him, kind of go to the wrong side of the play and then, kind of have to reverse directions from time to time. There's a little bit too much of that for him to be, again, a top 10 to top 12 pick. For me, I've kind of been burnt in the past by an inside linebacker who had ideal athleticism but didn't have those instincts. He went around pick 30. That was Stephon Anthony out of Clemson, who went to the Saints. Just didn't have those instincts. He was at Clemson. He had a ton of really big defensive linemen like a Grady Jarrett in front of him who was constantly eating those blocks, was able to flow to the football. But then when he got to the NFL level and when he had to fight off those blocks and kind of use his instincts a little bit more, things fell apart for him. He's stuck in the league, but has never certainly lived up to that first round moniker. On the flip side, you've got a Devin Bush who has instincts upon instincts. He's going to flow to the right spot almost every single time. The coverage is interesting because you watch him at the combine and he flips his hips like he's a safety or even a cornerback. I mean, it's ridiculous the athleticism this guy has, but you kind of look at what Michigan specifically asked him to do on third downs, and they did not ask him to cover, which is usually kind of a tell that maybe they didn't specifically trust him in coverage. They used him a lot more as a spy. They used him in zone. They used him to blitz a lot, which he was really, really effective at, but they didn't ask him to cover a bunch, which could be a tell that, again, maybe they didn't feel comfortable with him doing that. The bigger question for me is, at that size, of course, he's like 5'11", 220. He's really inside linebacker. You see some of these big 300-pound athletic guards and centers getting to him on the second level. I think he's going to struggle with that a lot more. And while run defense, you can kind of give or take that. And if you've got a Kenny Clark and a Mike Daniels and some of those guys up front, that's certainly going to help as well. Again, if I'm picking an off-ball linebacker in the top 15, I kind of want my cake and, eat it too. I want everything. And I just think there's a little bit too many question marks for both of the Devons for that to be a pick. All of that being said, All of that being said, it would take me all of about 10 seconds to get, you know, behind them taking either of these players at 12, because it's a position that they could use an upgrade in athleticism. They could use an upgrade in speed, and these guys would be off the charts athletic enough to add that trait to the middle of this field. So it would be a weapon that they don't have on defense right now that they could use. It's just probably not the ideal scenario with a top 12 pick.
Right. And we've been burned in the past. The last time the Packers actually had a real high pick was number 5 overall, and they used it on AJ Hawk, which, hey, he had a nice cup of coffee in Green Bay for a couple of years, but he was never the standout he was supposed to be. But so, like I said, I listened to Lewis Riddick earlier today, and I appreciate a lot of what he says too. And one of the things he said about Devin White, though, is that, and you'll probably agree with this too, like you said, I'm like you, like, I don't want an off-ball linebacker, you know, that this high up. But the one thing he did bring up, though, is that a lot of what the league, you know, the Patriots have been doing it for years. A lot of the league is starting to come to this now, is with the tight ends and the running backs catching passes over the middle, is that the often undervalued or devalued safety and middle linebacker position is becoming more and more important. Because, I mean, all you had to do is watch Anthony Barr versus the Rams last year and see what happens when you get a linebacker out of place trying to cover people. And while Blake Martinez is a great tackling machine, he's limited in his coverage abilities, and maybe that makes it a little bit more value for Devin White, like kind of like how Kyler Murray isn't the first overall pick unless it's the Cardinals, because the Cardinals are the only ones who need him. So if they don't take him, he won't be number one. But maybe Devin White holds a little bit more value to the Packers because they don't have that middle presence right now, and they're trying to rebuild it with Amos and possibly a new inside linebacker. Is there anything to that, maybe?
Thinking? Yeah, I mean, the old adage is you start in the middle of the field and you work your way out. And that kind of went away for a little while, and now it's coming more and more in vogue. But, you know, usually you want to start with your, you know, defensive interior, making sure that people can't run up the middle. Then you have a strong inside linebacker who's going to be able to cover that entire center of the field and have great range. That's why some of those, you know, Ray Lewis and Brian Urlacher defenses were so incredibly difficult to play against, because they covered so much ground in the middle of the field. And then you've got two deep safeties in the middle of the field who, again, if you've got high quality players there, it's going to be a lot more difficult to get big plays. So again, the old adage was, you know, work your way, you know, work inside out when you're building a team on defense. And then, like I said, that kind of went away, and edge rusher and cornerback became more valuable. And, you know, it just depends on what the defense wants to do, what Mike Pettine wants to do. He seems to value corner quite a bit. You know, whether or not he wants to put a ton of value in inside linebacker remains to be seen. But I will say, unquestionably, both of these players would be able to very, very much succeed in Mike Pettine's defense, and would be primetime players and both Pro Bowl caliber players, the way that Mike Pettine would use him, especially in some of those middle blitz packages. So I think there's a ton of value there. And like you said, with the way, look at the Patriots are a great example. It's constant checkdowns to running backs and tight ends. And if you don't have the type of players who can match up with that, they're going to take advantage of it. So that's why these guys are being talked about as top 15 players.
Yeah, and I think that's always – I always have to check myself on that, because I think inside linebacker, middle linebacker is kind of my – it's my my soft spot. I have a soft spot in my heart for a good middle linebacker, and just the way that the NFL has changed the linebacker position, there's just so many smaller linebackers now, because they have to follow James White, you know, and those sorts of things. But
what was that list that Andy put out this last week on Twitter about most regrettable picks by position or something like that? And he put Nick Barnett on there, and I knew that was going to make you mad right off the bat.
Not mad. I'm just hurt. That's
all. Hold on. Let me clarify. It was regrettable, or I didn't like Day it of. At the time. I was obviously wrong. I really wanted Boss Bailey in that draft, which is why. Okay. It was at the time of the pick. I was livid that they took Nick Barnett over Boss Bailey. Total transparency. And that was what, like 14 at the time, I think, something like that. you know, Nick Barnett, I didn't know a ton about. It was no disrespect to Nick Barnett. I had just, you know, Boss Bailey was Champ Bailey's cousin. I watched him a ton, and I was just super high on him. And of course, Nick Barnett went on to have the much better career and was a really great end of first round pick. And one of the best inside linebackers that the Packers have certainly had over the course of the last couple decades. So it turned out great. It was just at the time, it was the one I was most upset about.
Well, Andy, on this podcast or on last week's podcast, tried to lump Nick Barnett in with Brian Noble and Johnny Holland, and I got verbally eviscerated. So
very different.
And that tweet came out like a day later.
Well, for me, the most hurtful part about the pick was that Nate Wayne had been number 54 for the Packers for a couple of years there. He had left that year to go to Philadelphia. 54 was open. And I have a Green Bay Packers jersey with my name, Barnett, on the back that says 54, because that was my old high school number. And there was no, I wanted one because all the other players leave. And I was never going to leave. So I wanted a jersey for me. And then they picked Barnett. I was like, oh, give him 54. And they gave him 56. And then I would go to games and people are like, hey, man, your jersey's wrong. And I'm like, I'm Barnett. I was here first.
I was here first.
Too funny.
So, yeah.
Hey, Andy, before you go, I got to ask two questions here. I want to clarify something. So let's say TJ Hawkinson is still there when 12 rolls around. And then also, too, let's say, I don't know, someone like Juwan Taylor, for whatever reason. And of course, if Ed, what's his name from Houston?
Oliver.
Ed Oliver. Obviously, you take those people no matter what, despite need, right?
Well, if you followed him on Twitter.
That's an interesting question. What's that?
I said, you follow him on Twitter. You saw his top picks. You had at 12 either Jonah Williams or Ed Oliver. Mm-hmm. And then Marquise Brown at 30 and Thornhill at 44 was your. I think that was the one you had there.
That's kind of my dream draft. That would certainly be, and Oliver would probably be the guy, over Jonah there. So Oliver's a no-brainer, and I think it's looking less and less and less likely that he makes it to 12. But if he does, to me, that's an absolute no-brainer, and it's just because the NFL overthought that pick, and he should be gone by then. If he's not and Green Bay passes, I think that's of all the dream scenarios, that's kind of the nightmare scenario. If he's there, take him and just don't overthink it and figure out the rest later. Right. Hawkinson is really interesting. I love TJ Hawkinson. Justice Mosqueda makes a great argument to not ever really take tight ends in the first round. And I tend to kind of agree with that in general. I'm not quite as against it as I am against running backs round one, but besides running backs, tight ends probably the next closest of, try to kind of avoid it. And at pick 30, it makes a lot more sense. But 12 is really, really rich for a tight end. And I don't mind Hawk because I think he's that ridiculously good. But if you take a tight end at 12, man, you have to be right. And he can't just be good. He's got to be great. And again,
he's going to be the next Gronk, basically, which, yeah.
Or, I mean, even George Kittle. I mean, if you tell me he's going to be George Kittle, Travis Kelce good, I would trade the 12th pick in the draft for one of those guys right now. I wouldn't have any issue with that, but you can't miss. You have to hit on a player like that. And I think the other thing that adds value there is he fits perfectly in Matt LaFleur's offense. So it wouldn't be my pick. And I think you'd have to really kind of vet that out is the positional value there at pick 12. I'd prefer a trade down, but then again, you probably lose him if you trade down. So there's that total dynamic there. And then as far as, Taylor, really good player, boy, that's a tough one. I would have to kind of know who else is available at that point. As far as tackles go, I like both Jonah Williams as well as Andre Dillard a little bit more than I like Taylor. In fact, probably a lot of bit more than I like Taylor.
Well, Jonah's a genius. That guy keeps track of every single snap, every single opponent. He's got notebooks and spreadsheets and spider charts. He's ridiculous.
Yeah, crazy.
Yeah, he's just a football junkie, which you have to love. And then he's got great tape at SMT school at Alabama. He's got positional versatility. So you try him at tackle first. You let him fail there first if he's going to, and then you move him to guard. And at worst case scenario, he should be a great guard. So I like Jonah a lot. I love Andre Dillard. I think he's one of the best pass blocking tackles that's come out in the past few years. But he has less value in Green Bay than he does anywhere else because he's such a great left tackle. And of course, that's one position that Green Bay has zero need for. Is left tackle. So you'd have to kind of change him to right tackle, which he's not as good at. He's got to learn a new position, and right tackle is less valuable than left tackle. So while I love Dillard, again, he has less value here than pretty much everywhere else. So I would have no issue with Taylor at 12, but it would be more dependent upon who is there.
Yeah. It's always dependent on what you've got in front of you and how everything falls. And I've mentioned it in terms of the tight end stuff. We've talked about a couple times here on our podcast. I wrote something for Fake Teams. It was either beginning of last season or the year before. And it was a fantasy football take. Basically, never draft rookie tight ends in your fantasy football team. And I don't care where they go to or how great they were in college. Travis Kelce had zero catches as a rookie. Rookie tight ends are notoriously not useful. It has the one of the longest learning curves in football. You have to be patient. And for pick 12, I don't want to be patient at pick 12. You know, I don't want to have to wait a year to see if it worked. And for tight ends, it's very, very common to have to wait that year to figure out if they're any good. And at this point, I want to see how much Robert Tonyan gets better over the year.
You just stole my segue. I was just going to say that because he mentioned Kittle. And I was going to say, some people say that Kittle's already on the roster and his name's Robert Tonyan. And he's just needs that one more year to produce. And he didn't have a real good shot at it last year.
No.
Yeah, I mean, I think anyone who knows me knows I'm pretty much one of the biggest, Robert Tonyan guys around. And I was on him, as early as one of the mini camps last year when I got to see him in person for the first time. I just don't think you make any draft decisions or anything like that based on Robert Tonyan at this point. You hope for the best. I think he has a lot of upside. But this is still a guy that's probably ideally a number three tight end until he proves you otherwise. And if he surprises you, great. But again, I don't think you're making any first or second round decisions or probably any draft decisions at tight end simply because Robert Tonyan's on the team. But I definitely think there's a lot of upside there. And I think he has a ton of value down the road, hopefully as a receiving tight end. But he still has a ways to go before he shows that he's even ready to be a full-time number two. But I definitely think he can get there.
Well, that's why I'm just saying that I would rather wait and see if Noah Fant is available at 30 than go tight end early. Just because of the learning curve at the position is the only take I have. I'm not saying don't take Hockenson because you've got Tonyan.
I don't think most the tight ends league. Don't start performing until their second contract, which is why you see a player like Eric Ebron, who was the last tight end to go top 12, I believe. Yeah. And he didn't really do much in Detroit. He goes and gets his second contract in Indy and has kind of a breakout season last year. So we've seen a lot of other tight ends that took that long to develop. Like you said, Kelsey didn't have any catches his first year. You know, Kittle broke out early, but still his first year was much, much less than what he did last year in San Francisco. And that was even still a pretty fast learning curve as far as a tight end's considered. So to expect to have that value right away, again, you might be waiting until year four or five. And then what gets interesting is, and the Lions ran into this with Ebron as well, when you end up, those first 4 years, Ebron didn't do much. Then you have the decision of, well, do you want to give this guy the huge fifth year option? They didn't because he didn't perform up to that point. So then, of course, he walks and the Colts pick him up and then he has his big year. So you kind of get into no man's land too, where you're kind of darned if you do, darned if you don't. So there can be some complications with picking a tight end that high in the draft.
Yeah, well, going from Stafford to Luck.
In the case of Richard Rodgers, it was about a 6-year learning curve and it just never came around.
Yeah, some people just don't have it.
Yep. Yeah, nobody, not everybody gets there. There's only two other things. Because we are running short on your time, and I definitely appreciate having you here for all of this. The two other quick things I do want to talk well quickly. First one, a lot of talk about Drew Lock falling all the way to 30 and the idea that the Packers might take him. I guess, what are your thoughts, likelihood he falls, and your thoughts about taking him at 30?
So, yeah, that's the real interesting topic. Let me start by saying I am fully on board. If you believe you are taking a franchise quarterback, a franchise caliber quarterback, I don't really care who you have on the roster, Mahomes in Kansas City. If you're sitting at a spot ever and you think another franchise quarterback falls to you and you want to take them, I have zero problem with that because it to me is the single most important position in all of sports. One draft pick does not make or break you one way or the other. If you're doing your job right, you're going to have a successful draft regardless of this one pick. I don't think it makes or breaks a draft class. And if you have two phenomenal quarterbacks, to me, that is a great problem to have. And you kind of figure out the rest later and you hope maybe you can have them on the roster for 3 or 4 years and then flip them for maybe a top 10 pick in the draft. So I'm fully on board. If you think you're taking a franchise quarterback and in full belief of that player, go ahead and take them. We saw obviously the Packers do it with Aaron Rodgers. We saw the Patriots do it to an extent with Jimmy Garoppolo, even well before Brady was ready to retire. I just don't have a problem with that philosophy in general. That being said, I do not see that scenario playing out in this draft, at least how I view these quarterbacks. Kyler Murray's the only one that I would really honestly have a true first round grade on. And I even have enough concerns with Murray and the issue there. One, he's going to probably almost for sure go number one overall. And two, even let's say in some insane circumstance, he falls to 30. As soon as the Packers take him, he's just going to threaten to play baseball unless they trade him to a place where he can play. So that's not a scenario. I'm not a Haskins guy. I'm not a Locke guy. I'm not huge on Daniel Jones, excuse me, either. So I don't think that that scenario plays out in this draft. From Drew Lock falling to 30, I don't see that happening. I think he's probably gone well before that. I don't think they even sniff him at 12. That would be one of the worst case scenarios, but I don't think that happens. If he falls to 30, if you were to say one quarterback scenario actually played out that way, if he falls to 30 and they took him, okay, it's not the best pick. And like I said, I'm not a Drew Lock guy. He has a lot of upside. He has a rocket arm. He can make a ton of throws. If he comes in and sits behind Aaron Rodgers for 3 or 4 years, yeah, maybe they could legitimately develop him into a big time quarterback. And then in 4 years from now, you make that determination if he could be the guy. So the last thing I'll say here is, if you're going to make that move, you have to get it right. And he has to be phenomenally talented. And this can't be like a couple years ago when they were thinking of picking DeShone Kizer at pick, 33 when they took Kevin King, and then they traded for him a year later, using basically a first round pick, Demarius Randall, to trade him to get him. You can't really mess that up. And I just don't see Drew Lock being that guy. I think this is more of a smokescreen. I think Peter Bukowski had a great point about this, and actually kind of Gutekunst echoed this today. They're going through the process of looking at quarterback because in the next 3 to 4 years, when I think all of them are hopefully, still on staff, they know they're going to have to take a quarterback within that next 3 to 4 year period. And they want to know how to go about it. They want to go through the process. They want to know how to bring guys in and vet those players, know what to look for, know what they did right, know what they did wrong. And so they're going through the full process of doing that with a Drew Lock. And then he's probably going to go to another team, and then they're going to get to see how he turned out and what things they were right about and what things they were wrong about. So in 3 to 4 years, when they, and maybe it's next year, maybe it's 2 years from now, but whenever that situation hits and they want to take a quarterback, they've gone through that process and know exactly what to do. So I think that's more of what's happening here.
Okay.
Hey, caveat off the end of that. First of all, Andy, make sure to go check out Pete Prisco from CBS Sports, his mock draft. If the Cardinals decide that they're not going to take Kyler Murray because they just spent so much for Rosen last year and won't get anything back for him, basically Murray would fall to 13 to the Dolphins. And then the other thing is, so you talk about replacing Aaron Rodgers. So Aaron Rodgers right now is 35 years and 5 months old. Brett Favre was 35 years and 8 months old when they drafted Aaron Rodgers. So there you go.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's definitely some differences in that scenario just a little bit, because one, I think Tom Brady has raised the bar just a little bit. I think, and actually Brett Favre, really has too, where these quarterbacks can be successful, almost into their 40s and still have a tremendous amount of success. And I think the other obvious difference here is that, at the time they picked Aaron Rodgers, Brett Favre was on his about 8th go around of wondering if he was going
to
come back.
That's what I was just going to say, because Aaron Rodgers hasn't tried to retire 5 times.
No, and he's basically said he's wanted to play, up right until, the end of this contract at minimum. So I definitely think there's a difference here. But again, you are a play away at any given time. Let's not forget, by the way, that Aaron Rodgers had another serious concussion in week 17 of last year, and a game he probably should not have been playing in. I respect Aaron Rodgers for wanting to play in that game. There's no way the team should have let him, but he suffers another serious concussion. He's at minimum, I think, 3 pretty, decently serious concussions at this point. And that's really nothing to mess around with. And we've seen with Sam Shields, you take one bad hit, you can be out of the league for a year or two before you're ready to come back and play. So that is a concern that I think Green Bay should have. We've come to the point where we've seen small signs of decline with Aaron Rodgers. He has not been able to stay fully healthy now for two seasons in a row. He's missed significant time. This is not just a scenario where you're looking at 5 years down the line. You have to protect yourself again in situations where he can't finish a season, where he takes one more huge hit to the head and could be done for a while. If he tears an ACL, heaven forbid, there's just a lot of scenarios there where I just don't think if you ever have the opportunity to take a phenomenal quarterback, take him. Just don't mess it up. You better be right.
Okay, I just want to say now, so if Marquise Brown is there at 30 and they take Drew Lock, can he replace Nick Barnett on your list for round one? That's all I want to know.
That's a great question. I think I was probably a more irrational fan at 14 than what I am today. And I don't know that I necessarily had the mindset to look at the upside of what Nick Barnett could potentially bring. I might be a little bit more lenient at Drew Lock and give him a second, but he would be up there on my list if they took Drew Lock at. I'll tell you this: if they took Drew Lock at 12, then he will beat out my Nick Barnett for maybe the most upset I would have been at a pick. And okay. Certainly, if they took Daniel Jones at 12, then we can have a severe conversation here.
That would be fun. I'd like to have you on to have that explosion. That would be amazing. The only other thing I wanted to talk to you about is my draft crush, my personal draft crush. Later on, possibly still third round, if Amani Hooker is there, I want to hear your thoughts on Amani Hooker out of Iowa.
Yeah, so third rounds, I like that you said that. And I think they probably are going to look at safety a little bit earlier than that. I think at 44 or 30, a safety makes a ton of sense for them, whether it's a Juan Thornhill, Chauncey Gardner-Johnson, maybe a Darnell Savage. I think one of those guys could make a lot of sense earlier. But let's say they get to that third round. They haven't taken a safety yet, or maybe they even want to take one more guy, because let's be real, they don't know what they have in Josh Jones. Raven Green is somebody that has gotten some nice praise, but they don't exactly know what they have there. And right now it's just Adrian Amos and some guys that they aren't sure of, especially if they want to move Tremont back to corner, which they've kind of made mention that they want to do. So let's say even they take Juan Thornhill at 30 or 44 and Hooker's staring them in the face in the third round. They could easily still go in that direction, but he's a player to me. He lacks some of those high athletic traits, at least that like a Thornhill does. He's just a good football player. And, sometimes it's not always pretty. Sometimes you wish he had a few more of those traits, but like I said, he's just one of those players. He's a classic Iowa football player. You just get them on your team and they figure out a way to be successful, whether it's an Aaron Campman, whether it's a Micah Hyde, all of these players have just kind of come in and had success. And I think if you pick him up in the third round, I think that's a really solid pick. I'd be hesitant to take him much higher than that.
Right. Yeah, I'm not talking about him in a second. I think that'd be too early to go. But I just like him. I hate having a draft crush who's going to be a first-round pick, because that's just a guy you know is good. If you want to have a draft crush, have it be somebody you're going to see a little later that you've actually like looked around for a little bit, and you're like, man, this is going to be an interesting guy to look at. I think he's got nice ball skills. He seems to read the field well. Like you said, he's a solid player. He knows where he's got to be. He works well in schemes. He can play at the line or back. Maybe not the high-end talent, which pushes him down to third round, but yeah, he's got some of those Micah Hyde kind of qualities that I just think are interesting to have, and you're going to get good play out of him at least. So, but we've run out of time with you and we've taken up a lot of your time. So I definitely do appreciate it. Aaron and I thank you again for coming on. We're grateful. Anytime you come on the show, and you're always welcome back, of course.
Well, I appreciate you guys having me. I hope you guys both enjoy the draft, and may the draft board fall ever in your favor. And I hope you guys get all the players you want, including Amani Hooker.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you again, Andy.
You bet. You guys have a great night.
Yeah. Bye. All right. And again, thank you to Andy for joining us again. It's always wonderful to have him and all of our wonderful guests coming onto the show. Now that we've had some good Packer news and some good Packer talk, we're going to delve into the Brewers this week, who are a little bit more of a letdown to us. It was a rough week. The Brewers' schedule to start off the season has been kind of brutal just to look at it. I mean, tons of games against the Cubs, get the Angels and then Dodgers out in L.A., and then St. Louis, and then the Dodgers, and then St. Louis. I mean, just playing a bunch of teams who are very good right off the bat this week.
Right.
From the 14th on.
The stat was like, the Brewers only have like six games left against the Cardinals the rest of this year or something like that. It's something ridiculous like that.
And this week they got a series win against the Cardinals at home. They took 2 out of 3 against the Cardinals, lost the game on the 17th on Wednesday. But yeah, then they got the Dodgers Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Saturday, listening to the game on my way into having the Easter vigil with my parents, and two home runs from Yelich, and then the three run home run from Braun there did all the scoring. And even though Drunk David Stearns, our dear friend Drunk David Stearns at Drunk David Stearns on Twitter, said he thought that there was going to be quite a few home runs by Chase Anderson in that game. Chase Anderson went five scoreless, and the bullpen closed it out. Home game against the Dodgers. But since last Sunday, the Brewers have gone 1-4 against the Dodgers, and that has massively hurt their current standing in the division. And four of those games were at home. So the Brewers now just went final in a 13-5 loss to St. Louis. Now just 13-11.
The Brewers haven't had a day off since the 11th. That's the 11th straight day in a row that they've played a game. I didn't even realize that, because it was a four-game series against the Dodgers. I mean, so yeah, the last time they didn't play was between when they were out in California, between when they played the Angels and when they played the Dodgers. And since they came home on, or when they were out in California against, Thursday, the 11th was the last day off they had.
Yeah, and it's been, like I said, the schedule this year has just been tough up front. The Brewers last year started off getting an incredible lead in the division because they didn't play a lot of people up front. They had a tougher schedule in the back half than the front half, and they still managed to hold it out. But I mean, like, let's see, 28th through the 31st, the Brewers took 3 out of 4 against St. Louis. Early, I'm trying to think of all their games here. I'm just going through March and April. They played St. Louis, 15th, 16th, 17th. Took 2 out of 3 there. They've been playing great against St. Louis. Now they're in St. Louis. Those two series were in Milwaukee, where Yelich hits all of his home runs because he does not hit any other.
And so the first day off that they get is the 25th. So they play 14 straight days. But it's not like a real day off because they go from St. Louis to New York and play in New York on Friday.
Yeah, and then you get a break in the
back to Milwaukee and play on Monday again. That's ridiculous.
So we'll see if Yelich can get his first road home run here. He's got 6 games in 7 days to do it. And pardon me again. I'm glad nobody's trying to make the crazy talk or crazy idea that Yelich can only hit in Miller Park or anything like that, because he's definitely going to hit elsewhere. He has 13 home runs now. He has already beaten the Brewers' record for most home runs in March and April. It is currently the 22nd. He's got another week, little over a week yet, to hit any more. And you're crazy if you think he won't hit one more in that time. Obviously he's not going to stay on this pace, but how great has it been to watch this run by Yelich?
I'm still getting over their schedule right now. The Brewers have one game off between April 11th and May 8th. That's one day off in a month. That's anyways. Yes, Yelich is awesome though, dude. How about that?
it's been an amazing run, and he's kind of carried
still
a lot of people
because there's still 8 days left in this month, and he already broke Prince Fielder's record for most home runs in a month by a Brewers player. I don't even know what the major league record is, but he's got to be getting up on that here pretty quick, too.
Well, and it was Thames' record for most home runs before the end of April that he broke, 12, and he hit 13 now. And the thing is, too, is we've needed all of it because the Brewers have not had a lot of other people really given a ton of stuff. And now Moustakas he's got a broken finger. So he's day to day. So we'll see how much we're going to get him in there in the last couple of games. But yeah, Shaw hasn't been hitting like we'd like. Zombie Ryan Braun has been doing very well. He's got 4 home runs now or 5. He hit one the other day against the Dodgers in the 21st and the 20th too. The 21st was a rough game. Yelich had a home run stolen from him by Cody Bellinger, who's also in the home run top leader group there. And then Bellinger, after the Brewers tied it on Thames' late home run to make it a 5-5 game, Bellinger is, of course, the guy who hits the home run to put them back in the lead.
Right.
That 5-6 loss, it was really tough seeing that. But, I mean, the Dodgers and the Cardinals, just you're getting that many in a row. You're going to have stretches. Baseball is a game where everybody has stretches. You know, it's what they always say, you win 50, you lose 50, unless you're the Orioles. And then, you know, you just see what you do in the other 62 games, makes up your season. But yeah, unless you're the Orioles, everybody wins 50 and everybody loses 50.
Right. And I think about it too. And so in the meantime, the Minnesota Twins, due to snow and just bad luck on the road with rain, they're already on like their second doubleheader. And they've they played 7 games in 14 days, which is just the opposite of it. So it stinks up front for the Brewers with all these games packed side by side by side. But if you've ever looked at a schedule, there's never more than just a couple days off in a month anyhow. But the one nice thing about having a covered stadium in the Midwest and no rain delays, have the Brewers had a rain delay so far? I don't think they have.
No, I don't believe so.
So you don't have to make up any games. So when teams like, you know, Cleveland and the Chicago teams and Minnesota that are having rainouts and snowouts in the beginning of the season, so when they're trying to pack in double headers on top of other games midweek at the end of August and September to make up games, the Brewers won't have to be doing that. And that's actually kind of what helped the Brewers down the stretch last year too, because I think the Cubs had an insane amount of games through the end of August and September because they had to make up some rain delays and stuff. If I'm correct, I don't know.
Yeah, something like that, because they had all the extra times there. Coming up for the Brewers, though, looks a lot better. They're going to play a couple series against the Mets, who are currently 11-10. They're going to play one against Washington, who's 10-10. And then they get Colorado as well, who's 9-13. Yeah, they've got a better look coming up here, so they should be able to make up some games quickly. Also, Nelson appears to be close to getting a rehab assignment. So he's looked good in Arizona. They've been keeping him there in Arizona. And hopefully we can start seeing him pitch somewhere in, you know, San Antonio pretty soon. See what we can see from him and get him a chance to get ready and start coming up. Because with Burns being pulled out of the lineup there, it's going to be a rough little stretch here until we can find somebody else to step up. Yeah, I'd rather see Burns. There was some discussion on this on rather you'd rather have Burns go down to the minors, use the option, and then have him continue to work on being a starting pitcher, or have him stay in the major leagues, work some closing innings, stuff like that, late innings for you in relief, and then build back into the starting role. And I think I go with just keep him in that starting role. If you want him to be a starter, he's got to work on his longevity. He's got to work on reading the full game and getting through a lineup several times. The mechanics of it are one thing, but he's got to get into that feel of a game, I think. And I prefer to have him go to the minors and just do that and get better at that.
Roger, absolutely. No, it's... I mean, it's what was Mike Keller was talking about last week. You've invested so much time into getting this guy to where he is now. Don't mess it up. Don't do weird stuff. Keep the course. It's been a long time. Don't make some the Brewers pitching needs help right now. Absolutely. But don't make a knee-jerk reaction on this guy, because you know, with him, with Nelson, he's going to do whatever you ask. And if you tell him to go out and start tomorrow a Major League Baseball game, he will. Because it's his mindset, because he's an ultimate competitor. But no, you've got to take your time with him. And yes, do it right. Make him a starter. I mean, and treat him like a starter and get him ready to be a starter again. So, or if you found something critical now and you know that he's never going to be able to pitch enough innings to be a starter again, then yeah, move him to the bullpen and make him a bullpen pitcher. A bullpen pitcher, because, you know, maybe he doesn't have it in his shoulder anymore to go more than just a couple innings. But I mean, then that makes sense to move him to the bullpen.
Yeah. And I think we'll start seeing too, just going forward, I think the pitching is going to start picking up a little bit. I'd like to see Burns get some time, get there. If we can get Nelson back into this lineup, get him some starts in here as well. That'll start shoring up a little bit. I like some of the stuff I've seen from the bullpen. We did get to see Hader in this last week, this rough week. You got him, see him rock twice.
Yeah, hard too.
We're not going to see a week like that from Hader often.
Well, and there, I think, I know for sure the one on Sunday was a hang. He hung a slider pretty bad, like right down the middle. And then, of course, it was the Bellinger was it Bellinger? Yeah.
Yep.
Bellinger? Yeah. Yep. Hang a slider on Bellinger anyways. I was trying to think if it was him or Peterson. I'm still having flashbacks from Peterson torturing us during the ALCS last or NLCS last year. I know the one on Sunday I watched live with my parents, and that was right after they got in the lead back. And yeah, he just hung that one. And I'm pretty sure the one earlier in the week, he hung a slider right over the middle too. But Hader's seen a lot more innings. I don't remember seeing Hader this much all of last year. And due to some of the, between Knebel being put on the IL and just having to rely on your best pitcher for wins, man, I think it might be a bigger problem going down the road, though, man. I don't know if Hader's capable to take this many innings.
I don't think they've put him in more than two games in a row, though. And when they pitch him two innings, they don't pitch him the next game. I don't think they've changed the rules on him. I just think they've played a lot more games in a row.
That's actually probably what it is. Actually, you're probably 100% right, John. There's been a lot of games stuffed in all at once. So, yeah.
So by the way, I think the best is still coming here.
Most home runs in a month is Sammy Sosa during the year, and he hit 20. The most legitimate, I guess you'd have to say, is Giancarlo, and that was in June. Sammy Sosa put out 20. Giancarlo Stanton put out 18 in August in 2017. Lots of 16s and 15s. Barry Bonds put out 17 in 2001. So yeah, so to get to the most by a lefty would be in a month would be Barry Bonds. So he's got five or four to go to get to that. And yeah, I don't know if he's going to hit six.
And
he didn't
do them all this month either, because he started off pretty hot. Some of those were in March.
Oh, that's right. Sorry, my bad. Yeah, so he's got a ways to go yet. So he's only at nine.
Something like that. So,
although he did tie for most home runs in the month of March, which all those are only in 18 and 19, because back in the day they didn't play in March. So
yeah. So I was trying to say there is the best on this team is still to come. They're going to be fine. It's going to be okay in there, and they're going to start hitting. We're going to see more from Shaw and some of these other guys. But getting forward here, we've got Bucks playoffs, and we have the first Bucks playoff series win since 2001.
Jack Sicamoto's on the team.
No, they're saying so it's 2001, which was okay. Cassell and Allen and Big Dog Robinson. And they said, yeah, since then, every single team has won at least one playoff series, including the Seattle Sonics, Supersonics. That team had a playoff win in 2005. Guess who was on the team in 2005? Ray Allen.
Yeah, that's right. Like, no. God, he did play for Seattle, didn't he?
Yep, just for that little bit before he went to the Celtics. And he had to be convinced to go to the Celtics because he needed to see that they were going to get somebody else in there. And they got Garnett, and then he said, okay, if it's Pierce and Garnett, then yes. Yeah. But not just Pierce.
Where was Sean Kemp still on the team then, or any of his children?
I don't remember if he was still on that team at that point. I don't know.
I'm looking right now. But yeah, the game today
was very close for about three quarters. I think it was 5:05 left in the third. It was Detroit 79-78. And then Detroit for the next 5 minutes scored about 6 points, and the Bucks got up by 13. And then they just walked away with it. There's long stretches of no scoring. The Bucks, they went like 4 minutes getting one basket. It was tough. I was watching this while we were recording it a little bit on my phone.
Thank God Andy had a lot of information to put out, because I was watching the game too. So you're right. And it was, Sean Kemp actually left the Supersonics in 97 and retired in 2003 with the Orlando Magic. But yeah, the Bucks outscored Detroit 71-44 in the second half. That's brutal.
Giannis had 41 points in this game, and he was just going straight through the defense in that second half. Like, Detroit wanted to win this. They did not want to get just walked through in four games. They did not want to get swept, and they just weren't going to avoid it. Milwaukee just has more depth. They have more talent on this team. Blake Griffin played, which early in the series, we didn't think Blake Griffin was going to play at all. We thought he was out for the whole series, but he played today. He had 22 points.
He got called out by both Shaq and Barkley on TNT for not playing. So I think some of the national media guys might have gotten into his head a little bit, and maybe he wasn't ready. But yeah, I mean, they flat out called him out for, if it was player's choice to stay out of the game, that's not good. But
yeah, he was 18 of 15, 4 of 6 on 3-pointers, had 5 rebounds, 6 assists. 22 points. Not a terrible game. He played 28 minutes. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Reggie Jackson led the team in scoring. He had 32 minutes. He had 26 points for the team. But yeah, Mirotić put in 12 off the bench, 16 from Bledsoe, another 18 from Middleton. But yeah, 41 from Antetokounmpo with 9 rebounds as well. He just was not going to be denied this game. And he was just in that second half, he was just cutting through people. It was just around them. It looked like they were done. They were just done at the end, except for Blake Griffin, who was furious.
Yeah, he was.
He just about got a technical because he started walking out onto the floor to yell about something in that fourth quarter with about 4.5 left, 4 minutes left. And yeah, they were pulling him back in. So yeah, I mean, that guy, he's used to being on teams that won in the last several years.
And he's a competitor. And like we talked about, you know, he's not where he was when he first came in the league and he was 14 feet up in the air, literally throwing the ball down through the hoop. Like that stuff was ridiculous. I remember when he came in, he was something else, but he's still not a bad player. He is a good player and he is the best player on Detroit by a long shot. And he's still top 25 in the league. So, I mean, and he's definitely a competitor. And I can only imagine just watch you could just watch, like I said, we were recording, so I'm only watching in the background. But you could just watch Detroit just melt away at the end of that one. Like, and just Giannis just could not be stopped. He was just running right up the lane and just laying it in or slamming it down. And he was playing like one of the biggest, you know, like we talked about with our buddy out in California a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about how
Rosenthal.
What's that?
Rosenthal.
Thank you. I had Andy's name stuck in my head and I couldn't think about it. But yeah, Rosenthal. You know, like all the rest of National, everyone outside of Wisconsin is like, all right, well, let's see what you got, man. All right, so the Bucks better start winning some series here. And all right, sweeping Detroit's a good start, and especially since being the Celtics sweep. Indiana?
Yeah, they swept Indiana. They got a 110-106 win. So we're not going to get any help there. We can get a little bit of rest here yet in the fact that the Eastern Conference is still going. Tomorrow, the Raptors have a chance to close out the Magic, and the Sixers have a chance to close out the Nets. Pardon me. Both series are 3-1. But, yeah, it would be great to see them take another game and have them play again on Thursday if they can. That would be great.
Yeah. Well, we're playing the Celtics now, so right?
Almost certainly, unless of course something weird goes on and these other teams lose.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, the Celtics look really real now. They look like the team that was in the playoffs last year.
Well,
that almost knocked off LeBron and the Cavaliers. So,
and the Pacers aren't really a 5 seed at this point, though, just because they're there because they played well early, and you know they don't have Oladipo, right? He's still out, and they just haven't looked the same. They haven't looked as good. I mean, and they only lost by 4 points today.
This is a big prove it series for the Bucks, though. I'll tell you that much because nobody knows what the Bucks are. The Bucks had a really good regular season, a lot like how Toronto has in the last couple of years too. They never showed up in the playoffs, and so this is kind of a big deal for the Bucks. It's like, yeah, you can run up the best record in the East again. Let's get to the conference championship finals, and we'll talk after that. I mean, you could see it with Giannis tonight, man. He wasn't going to be denied the next round. You know, Middleton's right there, Bledsoe's right there. They need to prove themselves. They really do, because you know, in a vacuum, yeah, if you play teams one game at a time, you're in, you're out. Nobody gets to really, you know, study you. Now these are 7-game series. You're the best against the best, and if the Bucks knock off the Celtics, it's going to shut up a lot of people.
And if they lose to the Celtics, this will have been a disappointing season because they need to win that. They need to get to the Eastern Conference Finals for me to be okay with the season, because this has been they've been too good to just give up a second round loss, and it will have been a disappointing season if they do.
The worst they can do is lose to Golden State in 7. That's the worst they can do for me. This team has the talent. They have the passion. Short of some games where nobody the Bucks have a really bad tendency to have games where nobody shoots well, where everybody plays bad all in one night. They got to take this. They got to take this and run with this. This is a great year.
So we're going to close out here. We don't have a lot of things we're going to get into in terms of little time, the smaller schools right now until they start getting closer to the end of the seasons here. So we're going to kind of round everything up here and just go right into our last call.
Time to look around and get your bearings. It's time for the last call.
So, Aaron, I got a couple little things I'm just going to mention. Saw on Twitter today that Russell Wilson, gifted all of his linemen $12,000 of Amazon stock. First off, why is he giving any gifts to those offensive linemen? Because they are terrible and they have done nothing for him.
He should be giving him money.
He is the most sacked, most chased, most hit, most pressured quarterback in football. Why is he giving them anything? Maybe he just thinks that this Amazon stock is going to tank and just have them watch their money disappear. I don't know.
They do make him look good because he has to put all of his talent on display to make it work. If they were good offensive line, we might not know how good Russell Wilson is.
Well, yeah, they don't pay any money to keep wide receivers, running backs, or offensive line. And they can put all their money into their defense because Russell Wilson is going to save them. He had, by the way, one of the weirdest, "Hey, we got a contract signed" videos ever. And it's terrible and strange and awkward. And I feel like we got a contract. It's awkward.
It was weird.
Unfortunate sort of video. I'm going to say this too. The schedule released by the NFL is the least interesting quote unquote event in sports. I don't care. I can't find a way to care. And I love the NFL. They could do almost anything and I will watch it, but I don't care about the schedule release. I already know who the Packers are going to play, who their home and road games are. There's little things you can get. Andy Herman had some great tweets about it. Like, hey, we have two teams we're going to play coming off of byes. Also, twice during the year, we're going to play teams coming off of a Thursday game, which means they have kind of a mini bye. You're like, that hurts. I was like, okay, that's useful. Don't care about the rest of it.
There's an algorithm they use to make the season depending upon or your schedule, depending upon where you finished. And you know what division you're going to play from the AFC this year.
Yeah.
You know that you're going to play everybody in your own division twice. You're going to play every other year against every other team in your conference.
That's you knew who you're going to play with as soon as the season ended. You knew what your calendar was going to look like.
Heller and Finkelman had it down. They only got one game wrong by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, just figuring it out on the air.
Yeah, you could pretty much do it. The only other thing that I do want to say is apparently today is the anniversary. 15 years ago, Pat Tillman killed in action. The only real NFL player that we had in our lifetime who went to go do that sort of thing. His story is incredible. And the sort of cover up to make it look more impressive is tragic and darn near criminal. I'll say this, though. That man is an incredible hero who did something that back during like World War II, players left for these things. Players left the NFL to go to Vietnam. Some of them got drafted and different things. Players left in different periods of time. It has not happened in my lifetime, except for Pat Tillman, who went. And he's somebody who needs to be remembered repeatedly for the fact that he not just walked away like Aaron and I did, but Aaron and I did not leave millions of dollars on the table to go do that. We did it because, first off, also it financially helped us. It helped us pay for school and did other things for us. And we made our own separate sacrifices, but not anything close to what Pat Tillman made, both financially and with the fact that he is somebody who laid down everything for this country and believed in it that he was doing. And think of Pat Tillman as we go through our days. Anything else, Aaron?
No, I know I agree with you. You said that very eloquently and very well done. So, yeah, you know, the only other person I can think of is Villanueva from Pittsburgh. And then who's the linebacker for the Packers? Gizzy. And then Darren College joined the reserves after he got out.
He did, yeah.
I'm sure there's other stories like it too, because two of those are very Packer related and Villanueva was a very high profile kind of guy in that situation. But yeah, no.
There was one running back from the Broncos who was a Marine veteran. I'm trying to think of what his name was, but I can't think of him right now.
Yeah. But no, what Tillman did, man, I mean, he gave up a multi-million dollar contract. He walked straight away from football and to the one of the most dysfunctional organizations in the NFL. I do have to give the Cardinals tons of credit because they still do play in the army camouflage uniforms at least once a year. I think that's their alternate uniform. So they come out with the camouflage jerseys at least once a year. And it's still in honor of Pat Tillman, the way he went out. It's still frustrating as an army veteran to know that the one man who gave up everything and he never had to do it. He was the main man in the NFL. He was a very good safety in the NFL.
Yeah.
Had a very promising career, gave it all up to join the military, and just to have the truth construed in such a way that, or misconstrued in such a terrible way at the end. He was an American hero, and we should all remember him as for forever. There we go. That's it, John. Sorry.
All right. So that's going to be our show this week. Let's see, Aaron has anything else to add on this?
No, that's fine. I agree.
Perfect. And so thank you. Again, you can follow us at ScaniJohnny1. at jbarn54 is where you can find me, and you can find Aaron at Cheddar Talk. You can also email the podcast at podcast@scannyjohnny.com, as well as go check out our website, scannyjohnny.com, and we have a Facebook page up for Scanny Johnny as well, where we post a bunch of our stuff, and you can reach out to the community of people who listen. All right, thank you again for listening to us. Remember, whether you are on the town or on the go, it is always on Wisconsin.
And that's what I said.
This has been the Scanny Johnny Podcast. Remember to find the boys on Twitter at ScannyJohnny1 or online at ScannyJohnny.com. Thanks for listening.